Welcome to DAO Today, a podcast that hosts lively and challenging discussions on decentralized autonomous organizations, DAOs. Alongside some experts and builders in the space, this podcast aims to promote your knowledge on everything DAO, discuss blockchain-related topics, and challenge the lack of diversity and inclusion in the industry. DAO Today podcast is hosted by Alexa Mill, aka Deluxa. There is a lot to learn about DAOs as a concept, what they are, and how to build decentralized while navigating the complexities of the regulatory environment. You will have an opportunity to learn from builders, change makers, legal, compliance, and other professionals. So follow and subscribe to DAO Today with Alexa Mill not to miss out on any episodes. I promise you will learn new things and have some fun along the way.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of DAO Today. I'm your host, Alexa, and today we have Louis who will be talking with us about securities. Hello, Louis, and welcome to DAO Today. It's a great pleasure to have you here.
Thank you for having me on. Delighted to chat about these topics.
Thank you. Great. So would you please introduce yourself a bit and what is your involvement in the industry?
Sure. So I had a pretty long career in more traditional finance before getting orange-pilled or whatever color pill you choose. In 2015, I represented a lot of large banks and companies doing complex financing transactions. And I did that really around the world. My particular specialty was working with companies from outside the U.S. And that required a lot of explaining of how our U.S. securities laws work to folks in a somewhat different setting. But nevertheless, I spent much of my career trying to help people make sense of the way our laws work here. I discovered blockchain, somewhere around 2015 and became convinced that that was going to be an important part of our future. Initially, I was a partner at a very large law firm and thought that that would be the right way forward. But I became clear, it's a wonderful firm where I was based, but it was difficult for large organizations. And of course, that's probably a theme around DAOs, right? It's difficult for large organizations to throw their arms around this fully and completely. And for a variety of reasons, some of them are perfectly legitimate, others are a little bit less so. And so we started our own law firm called DLX Law in May of 2018. So we're just coming up on our fifth anniversary. So we're very excited about that. And we specialize in representing a wide variety in the digital asset and blockchain space.
Great. Thank you so much, Anid. Thank you for taking the time to come today and discuss this very, very important topic. Recently, we've been hearing a lot about securities, the SEC, CFTC filings against various projects, and they're very persistent trying to label all crypto as securities. Would you please tell us what the securities actually are?
Sure. So I think, and I'm grateful for this format here, Alexa, because it does take a little bit of explaining. I think once we do explain it, it becomes a lot more clear. The starting point is, why do we even have securities laws? That's a good place to start. And what do they cover, right? Because if you don't go back to first principles, it's hard to understand things. And of course, I'm a U.S. lawyer. You can tell by my accent. And, my comments are going to be, really about U.S. law. U.S. law has permeated global law, and it's become kind of a dominant feature. But I am speaking only of U.S. law. In the U.S., we have a kind of interesting system called the federal system, in which there are both laws that govern the entirety of the United States and then state laws that govern just activities in a particular state. Up until the stock market crash of 1929, we had securities laws, but they were only at the state level. And so each state had slightly different variations on how this all worked, and no one state had the resources to really pursue securities issues that were kind of national in scope. The weakness of this was revealed in all of the issues that led up to the stock market crash, and the federal government stepped in and said, we need a national framework. And so they drafted the very first of our securities laws in 1933, so about three plus years after the crash. The whole basis, though, of those laws is, well, what is a security? What are we regulating here? And the easy part was sort of a normative definition. Well, the stocks, bonds, debentures, all the kinds of things that everybody thinks of as a security. But even back then, our Congress kind of understood that if you just limit the scope of these laws to things that, you know, are easily enumerated, stocks, bonds, notes, et cetera, then it opens the door for bad actors to say, well, I'm not selling you a stock, I'm selling you something else, but really it has the economic equivalent of being a stock or a bond or some other security. And so the Congress borrowed from state law a term, investment contract, which I suspect many of your listeners have probably heard at this point. But they didn't define that term. They just sort of took it on and said, hope people figure it out for themselves. It took about another 13 years or so for the Supreme Court of the United States to issue the famous SEC versus W.J. Howey case, which enumerated a test, which now I think probably all of your listeners know, or at least have heard of, the Howey test. And the Howey test was really the Supreme Court trying to give life to this concept. How do we protect people against bad actors who it's a kind of know it when you see it? There was another famous Supreme Court about obscenity and how do you define obscenity? And again, the judge in that case said, well, I can't define it, but I know it when I see it. And that's similar to the rule that we have with the Howey test. There's a certain I know it when I see it element. But the Supreme Court did create a very specific test, which I'll pause in a moment and talk about. But that's kind of how we got there. I would just say that that test, the Howey test, has created confusion and disagreements for 70 odd years before digital assets ever came along. So it's important to understand that the rise of digital assets and DAOs and other new kind of ecosystems was came into an environment that was already really complicated and nobody quite knew how it worked to begin with. There are many, many cases and people were constantly, you know, battling around that. I'll just keep rolling here. The famous Howey test, Alexa, which I usually joke if I'm doing public speaking that I have a tattooed on my arm up here, but y'all never know, is a contract, a transaction, or a scheme that involves an investment of money in a common enterprise with a reasonable expectation of profit. Originally, it said solely from the efforts of others. It's sort of functionally been modified to primarily from the efforts of others. So those factors all have to be present in an arrangement. But critically, it involves a contract, transaction, or scheme. The test does not speak specifically to an asset. And in fact, in all the years in which before digital assets came along, people tried to figure out, well, how do we apply this test? They never applied it to some asset. So if I said to you, Alexa, you know, I've got a great idea. Besides the law, I also, on the side, I'm aging whiskey. And I have casks of whiskey up in the Highlands of Scotland, and I've got like tons of them. And I'll sell you one of these casks. You'll be the owner of the cask of whiskey for only $10,000. And let me tell you, 5 years from now, when that matures, that $10,000 could be worth $35,000-$40,000. I mean, this is a great deal. You know, I'll take care of all the details. Are you in? I just pitched you a classic investment contract scheme. It's not that the whiskey that you would be buying was a security, somewhat self-evidently. It's the scheme in which I'm posing to you. You give me money, I'll give you something that you I'd like to think can't consume on your own. I have an entire cask of whiskey. So you don't have a consumptive interest, right? You're not buying it because, well, I'm having a really big party and I just need that whiskey. That makes a difference, right? If you said, like, actually 5 years from now, I'm planning to host this huge party and I am going to, you know, have all these people and I need a lot of whiskey, that would be a different kind of transaction. You have a financial interest. You don't want to consume the whiskey. What you want are the returns from a resale, and you're relying almost exclusively on me. You don't know anything about whiskey, I'm assuming, or at least aging it. And so that arrangement. So before we ever had digital assets, we had many, many, many schemes along these lines where somebody pitched someone, I need money. I'm not going to give you equity in a business in the normal way. I'm going to sell you something. You'll be happy about that because the price is going to go up and, you know, everybody's good. our rules in the U.S. say if I pitched you that, you would either have to be an accredited investor or I would have to register that offer with the Securities and Exchange Commission. And that process is very involved. It's, of course, costly and time consuming. But the idea is it provides protections. It gives you an opportunity to say, Lewis seems like a good guy, but now that I'm looking at these papers here, I'm not so sure whether this is a great return when you take into account this, that, and the other thing. I don't know. I'm not, you know, and at least the idea here is that if you do go into my little whiskey scheme, you do it with your eyes open and with knowledge of the risks and the tax implications and everything else. If you just sort of get on a, you know, Zoom call with me, I pitch it to you, you send me a check, there's a good chance you don't fully understand what you're getting yourself into. And so that's the core basis of this idea of an investment contract and the protections that our securities laws apply. It's not that people, you know, shouldn't be able to make investments. It's that without the guardrails of, you know, kind of government mandated disclosures, there's a good chance that people will be misled. So I'll pause there for more questions. I know that was a long one. It takes us up to, you know, our immediate issue.
Yeah, that's actually like a great comparison, though. I'm curious to ask you this. What if you gave me that whisk as a gift?
Yes, so that's a great question. If I gave you the whiskey as a gift and we did not, you know, you may have had an expectation that you'd make more money if you did not make any investment. So it wasn't, for example, not a true gift, but like I said, well, I'm going to gift you this whiskey. I think we all and your viewers all know where this is going, right? Around airdrops. But if you said, well, look, I'm gifting you this whiskey, but in order to get the gift, I'd like you to do 10 podcasts about the benefits of whiskey.
Okay. So in that case, it wouldn't be
providing value. There's a trade there. You're providing. It is not direct monetary value, but it's something you can do. So if I said, okay, you don't have to pay me any money, but you're going to give me value in some indirect way. What are you good at? You're great at podcasts. So I'm going to ask you to do that. That is, for our purposes, an investment of money. Because otherwise, if I had just come to you and said, hey, Alexa, I've got this whiskey business. I'd love for you to do 10 podcasts educating people. You'd say, sure, that'll cost you X, right? You know, unless, you know, we were the best friends and maybe we are. But for the purposes of our viewers, you would charge me. So that there is a trade there. And I think that's a challenge around airdrops. The SEC has on at least two occasions gone after schemes involving airdrops. In both cases, the issue seemed to be where there was a bounty or some other program. So it wasn't really sort of an airdrop per se, but there was a trade there. I'm asking you to do something and I'm going to give you something. That kind of trade is what I think in fairness is right. You look, it may be low value, but it's still value. And so we have to be careful about that.
Great. Thank you so much for that explanation. And I mean, it's definitely securities are very important for the industry now and for the past, because we have to be aware of the potential consequences that we will be having in near or longer future. And also, of course, for the whole industry, it's very relevant. So I'm curious to ask you, since, I mean, basically, each and every crypto does expect to rise in price, or at least some over time. Does it really make all crypto securities?
Well, that is the single most important question you just asked, Alexa, so thank you. That seems to be the position that regulators in the U.S. at least have kind of scoped out. If there is, you know, any reasonable potential for profit, and if there's anybody that you can sort of identifiably tag, the term the SEC used in some guidance they provided in 2019 was somebody who is an active participant. So that was the term they made up for this purpose. So you know, at any time, any transaction in that asset is a securities transaction. As you know, we published a discussion draft of a very lengthy paper really trying to explode that concept. I don't believe it's the appropriate application of the law because it inherently involves a sort of a difficult position, which I'll describe in due course. But right now, it appears that the SEC's position is, you know, as long as you can point to somebody who has some sort of active role in an ecosystem or a protocol, then as far as they're concerned, that you know, every single transaction is a securities transaction. And, you know, as lawyers, we counsel our clients carefully to be very careful of that. Even if we disagree that that's the right application of the law, we have to understand that's the way it's being looked at the moment.
And what does it mean for ICOs? I mean, because each and every ICO is regarded as a security. And the fact is that quite large amount of tokens are there to support the network, the dApp that the project is building rather than expecting to gain some money. I mean, of course, gain some monetary value, but not as the main goal. So what does this actually mean for future ICOs? And what can be expected in a way? How will that affect crypto industry in the future?
Sure, thank you. So I would say start with a sort of a basic sort of 2018 style ICO on the web with maybe a countdown clock, hurry up and buy, get some tokens. Perhaps the project is not fully developed. Maybe there's only a rough idea, a white paper. It's a really easy call to say that those transactions, not the tokens, but the transactions are investment contract transactions. And as you can see, that's why I wanted to lay out the base case. You know, there are cases where the purchaser of the token is giving money to the project team. They are in a common sort of goal with the project team to see the tokens become more valuable, and their expectations are driven almost exclusively by the project team. And so ICOs and in their most basic format, you know, very easily fit into that model. That makes the transaction a securities transaction. Many of the early ICOs were done to the general public without registration, and the SEC has appropriately come down on those transactions and said, hey, you can't do that, at least not without kind of coming to us. I don't think that's an area where the industry has a lot of concern or disagreement. It's really when you extend that, and it was the question you asked a moment ago, Alexa, when you extend that to say, okay, that transaction, when I fundraised, I brought in money from the public, and I'm using that to build out this network, fair enough. But when people are dealing in that token, what about those transactions? Does it make the token itself a security, or is it just the fundraising that's a security? And that's where you get into some very, very subtle nuances, but are critically important for our industry, right? Because if all the transactions are securities transactions, then they can only take place in regulated markets and by regulated broker dealers and all these other things, and it becomes really difficult, if not impossible, to use the tokens. If it's really just the fundraising part that's problematic, then that's a manageable, you know, issue.
And I mean, we had some cases where the SEC made their stance quite clear towards some of the projects. For example, they clearly stated they do not see Bitcoin as a security. However, they do regard Ethereum as a security in some other projects, such as XRP and some of the other projects. And why do they see Bitcoin as a not security? However, Ethereum is seen as a security.
I think in fairness, the SEC has been a little unclear on their stance on Ethereum. The famous speech, which of course became a subject of much discussion around the Ripple case, that the director of one of the main divisions of the SEC, the Division of Corporation Finance, a gentleman named Bill Hinman gave, also in 2019, called When Howie Met Gary Plastic. And in this speech, Director Hinman states that in his view, and this is not, you know, and he's very clear that it's not the entirety view of the entire SEC, which is a body, right? It's just his view as one individual. But he concludes there that whatever happened when Ether was initially sold in the crowd sale, he concludes that present sales of Ether are not securities transactions. And that was a very important speech, and it gave a lot of comfort to people that whatever happened in the past, there comes a point where the asset can be sold in something that's not a securities transaction. He referred to that as sort of sufficient decentralization, and that's come to be known as sort of this idea of morphing, the idea that an asset was a security and then later is not a security. More recently, in particular after the merge, there have been rumblings that the SEC has been rethinking this. Certainly commentators have been rethinking this, and some commentators have suggested somehow because of the merge that the Ether token has re-become a security. I don't know what exactly. It was always a security. It stopped and then started again. People are not very clear about this. But there, you're absolutely right, Alexa, to say that there are people out there saying that. I am not aware of the SEC formally saying that. What we've had is a reluctance on the part of the chair and anybody else in the commission, to my knowledge, to say definitively, to repeat the guidance that Director Hinman gave in 2019 and say, I'm confident that today transactions in Ether are not securities transactions. That has not been in any way revalidated or agreed. But that's very different, of course, from saying they think Ether is a security. I'll add one very technical note here, but quite important. I'm a former commissioner of the SEC's sister agency, known as the Commodities Futures Trading Commission, or CFTC, a gentleman named Brian Quintenz, tweeted that about Ether specifically, that how could it be that Ether was a security because Ether futures on Ether are traded in CFTC-regulated commodities markets. But the way our sort of division of responsibility works in the United States, if a particular asset is a security, it should be traded in a securities market, not a commodities market, a future of an asset. There's special markets for futures on securities called securities-based swaps. The fact that Ether futures are traded in commodities markets strongly suggests that they are indeed commodities and not securities. This is one of many conundrums in this space, but at least it would be an inconsistency if Ether was a security for futures in Ether to trade in commodities markets. If it was truly a security, futures on Ethers should trade in a SEC-regulated securities market, which are called securities-based swaps. So, for example, if I wanted to sell you a future on Apple shares, just Apple shares. So what is the price of Apple shares going to be, you know, a month from now? That would need to trade in a securities market, not in a commodities market, because the Apple shares are stocks, right? So if you have a future in Ether and Ether is a security, it should be in a securities market, at least the way our laws currently work, not in a commodities market. But in fact, it is in a commodities market. So what do we make of it? I mean, look, that's not dispositive. People can change their minds. Stuff can happen, right? But it's just indicative. So I just want to clarify that. On XRP, can I segue to XRP? XRP is, of course, a very different situation. The long-running case that the SEC brought against Ripple Labs in technicality and importantly, the way it works, it doesn't have anything to do with the XRP token. Both the SEC and Ripple Labs have tried to bring the token into the mix because of their own sort of advocacy. But in fact, it's a really straightforward case, just like our whiskey. The SEC says, hey, Ripple Labs, you sold a bunch of something. Doesn't really matter what. You sold a bunch of something. You brought in money. The people that you sold that something to did not have a consumptive interest. They weren't going to have a big, you know, XRP party. They weren't, you know, in fact, planning to make cross-border payments. That's not why they were buying the XRP. They were buying it for investment purposes. They liked the idea, and they thought in the future others would want that, as you might with the whiskey. You'd say, I don't need the whiskey, but I believe 5 years from now, the demand for that whiskey will be such that I'll turn a profit. Totally fair. Nothing wrong with it. It's just that is an investment activity. And you relied, the SEC alleges, you relied primarily on the efforts of Ripple Labs in order to achieve that profit. So the SEC's claim doesn't really turn on whether or not the XRP token is a security. However, both Ripple Labs and the SEC have made this kind of about a somehow sort of a mandate, what's the word I want, a ratification of the status of the XRP token, even when it's not in the mix, for various reasons that, you know, one can only speculate about. But that's a very different kind of case. The case that's actually much more relevant to what your listeners probably care most about, which is, tokens after they're sort of trading and in the wild is a case involving a Coinbase employee named Ishan Wahi. And I don't know, Alexa, if you're generally familiar with that. In that situation, this gentleman, an employee of Coinbase, is alleged to have had early information about new digital assets that were going to be listed on Coinbase. That had a, you know, almost always when added liquidity comes in, that has a positive price impact. The fellow figured this out, allegedly, and traded, bought the assets prior to their listing, sold them shortly after their listing. That is similar to what Nick Chastain did on OpenSea. But in OpenSea, there was a similar case of somebody buying NFTs before they were prominently featured. In that case, there were criminal charges from our Department of Justice, but it was not treated as a securities case. In the case of Mr. Wahi, it was both a criminal case and a securities law case. And so that really put a bright spotlight on the question, were those tokens, there were nine that were identified by the SEC, were they in fact securities at the time he traded in them? If they were, then they were very appropriate to bring insider trading claims. I would argue that they were not securities and that those claims are unfounded, but you know, that's for a court ultimately to decide.
Thank you for clarifying that. And also leads me to the question, like, we keep seeing that the question, are crypto securities or crypto commodities, or there is something else? Because to be fair, both laws are quite old and written in the time when blockchain technology did not exist. And it's difficult to apply something, as I believe the SEC's goes from 1933 and how it has goes from 1970 something, right?
40, so
46, thank you. So it's pretty old laws and probably not applicable on even on other type of that are non-digital assets, not as applicable. But when we talk about crypto in particular, that's novel technology for now. And what are some of the challenges of these laws that the current industry is facing in terms of it being quite old? And what crypto actually are? Are they securities, commodities, or do we need like a third term to better describe?
It's a great question, and it actually kind of segues us a bit into DAOs, which I know you're going to want to talk about. I actually take a somewhat a different view than a lot of other folks in the space. I don't believe there's anything particularly problematic about our federal securities laws. I don't think they're outdated. I think they're fine. I think they're just being misapplied, right? So one of the main points that we have, and I see you're frozen. Oh, there you go. Okay, you were frozen for a moment. Okay. One of the main problems that we have is that we have in our securities laws a clear theme that runs through every different type of security, and that is a legal relationship between the person who issued the security and the owner of the security, whether it's a stock, a bond, whatever it may be. All securities have an issuer, and that issuer is the person either you have rights against, for example, in debt, hey, you know, you owe me some money at this point, or you agree to do something for me, or you have an interest in them. You're an owner, you're a shareholder of some type, maybe a preferred shareholder, a traditional shareholder, but you have a clear legal relationship with someone who is identifiable, and we use the term issuer for that person. The catch with digital assets is there is no issuer. There's a seller of the digital asset, but similar to the whiskey, as an owner of the whiskey, it may be worth a lot, it may be worth nothing, it may be fraudulent, but it doesn't create any legal rights, nor does it even purport to suggest that by owning whiskey, you have rights. Now, in the whiskey cases, there were actually warehouse receipts, which is a type of sort of ownership receipt that would give you rights against someone. That's a little bit of a different case. But if we were talking about, you know, just a generalized commodity, and so I think it's reasonably clear One may reject the idea of digital assets and say, man, this is the dumbest thing I ever heard in my life. I'm going to pay money basically for a number. You got to be kidding me. And fair enough. Like, don't buy, you think it's a dumb idea? No problem. That's for you. Don't be buying a number. But that's all it is, right? It's simply what you own in our paper, and maybe you can link to it, you know, in your show notes. We go through this in an extensive section on what exactly it does mean when we talk about a digital asset. I think, you know, developers and people who are more technical understand this, but a lot of people do not understand what does it mean. And I think the word token can, for example, or coin can confuse people, even though they know there's no actual token. They sort of imagine that there's something, but there's not something. It's simply a number, a password, a private key that allows you to give instructions to a network of computer that causes that network to take some action. That's all it does. It's, you don't have a right to do that. If the network doesn't do it, you can't go to court and say, hey, network of computers, you didn't do something. No, so in our paper, we analogize it, for example, to if someone you found on the street, a key that went to a physical lock, the key opens the lock, it does something, but it doesn't give you any rights. You don't have the right to open the door. The right is a legal concept, right? I can say, Alexa, you know, behind this door, there's a present. Or there's a valuable thing, there's a little treasure chest. If you give me $100, I'll give you the key that lets you get that. Then later you go, well, that sounds like a good deal. That's worth a lot more than $100. I'm in. Let's go. Right? And you give me the $100. I walk away. You put the key in the lock. It's not opening. Wait, what? You know, you have a legal relationship with me. I took something of value from you, $100. I gave you something and made a representation to you. Hey, that'll allow you to open that door. It's not the key or the lock that's the problem. It's the relationship with me, right? This is the difference between a legal relationship, which a security creates, and just a thing or, you know, a key or a number, which doesn't create any relationship. So the private key does not do that by itself. And that's just such an important thing to understand in dividing. And that's why I don't believe it's particularly difficult to distinguish between a digital asset as a non-security and a commodity. You asked about two things, which I want to touch on. One is Bitcoin, right? Why does Bitcoin seem like it's okay? I think being not only the oldest and original digital asset, but also the most diversified, I think even the SEC has understood and accepted the idea that there really is no one person, entity, or company that fundamentally controls Bitcoin. I think, you know, even they understand that. And therefore, there's nobody to point to. Where it gets more complicated is where your digital asset does not give you a right against anyone, but you do have expectations about what someone will do. We'll come back to that in a moment, I'm sure. But that's you know, why Bitcoin is a bit different.
Also, the thing is about the Howey test is that says one of the criteria is that there is an investment in common enterprise. It's what deems it a security, what makes it a security. But what about DAOs? I mean, DAOs are by nature decentralized. And I mean, from my point of view, I would rather say that this is quite applicable to traditional type of entities when you do have that legal structure, which is highly centralized. However, a DAO operates on the basis of decentralization, on the involvement of the community, and there is some investment in terms of whether it's developing a chain, a network, or a project that aims to achieve something, either to help someone or to give out grants or to establish some sort of like a social environment. So what kind of risk do DAOs potentially can be a subject to because of this Howey test criteria?
Oh, it's a great question and a perfect point to segue. Our securities laws have long recognized that people can group themselves for a business venture without creating a security where there is sort of an equal effort put in by everyone. The most obvious of which is, let's say the two of us have really hit it off here and we want to start a podcast company. and we're going to start a new company. I'm going to bring some legal things. You're going to bring podcasting skills, your network. We're going to put that together. We might enter a partnership agreement between the two of us and say, we're going to be partners in this business, but we may never do that. We may just say, hey, Alexa, handshake, let's go do that. The two of us start a business. Our respective interests in that business, we may earn revenue, hopefully a lot of revenue, right? And become very successful. We may have liabilities. We might promise to do things and have obligations. Those are joint and several obligations. We can do that without either of us selling securities to the other because we're all kind of in it together. Well, let's say it just wasn't the two of us. Let's say we had five or six friends. We could still do that if everybody's, so you have a designer, I have someone who specializes in litigation, and we're kind of, well, it's a kind of bigger group. I obviously see where this is going. The question is, practically, how big can that group be and still sort of float as something where everybody is contributing and no one is primarily relying on any of the others? So the courts in the United States have actually addressed a somewhat similar situation, which does come up. It often comes up in particular in the area of real estate development, where people are going to come together. They've got an idea. Oh, here's a property. It's kind of run down. If we apply some capital and we do some things, we can turn it into something more successful, or we'll just build something new, whatever it may be. And if the people who do that functionally as a partnership, then there's no securities transaction. If something goes wrong, they can find other grounds for suing each other, but they can't sue each other because there was a security involved. In a famous case called Williamson versus Tucker, one of our circuits, so that's kind of just below our Supreme Court, looked at an arrangement like that and tried to figure out whether that arrangement was more like a partnership with no securities or whether it was more like an investment arrangement where there were securities. And they looked at three important factors, very different from the Howey test. What they said is, does everybody have the sophistication to make decisions that are relevant to the venture? So let's say I'm a lawyer, you're a podcaster, and we bring in my, you know, elderly Aunt Susan, and she doesn't know a lot about, you know, either podcasting or the law, but she kind of wants in on the whole thing, but she doesn't have the sophistication to understand what she's doing. She's really relying on the two of us. Well, honey, you seem so, that's a good idea, that Alexa lady, she's very sweet. I'll give you some money, right? She doesn't have the sophistication. Let's imagine a second case in which we find a third person, maybe a lawyer at another firm, who's super sophisticated, right? But we don't fully trust them, you know? And so we say, look, you can give us some generalized advice, but all decisions will be made by Alexa and me. That's the way it's going to be. They have the sophistication, but contractually, they're limited as to what they can actually do in terms of our arrangement. So it's not their lack of sophistication. It's that by arrangement, we're not giving them a vote, or we can say you can only vote in certain things, but really, this is the two of us. We're doing it. You know. That's a second problem. And the third problem is where, as a matter of practicality, the person may be both sophisticated and, in theory, able to participate, but in practicality, they just can't for one reason or another. Maybe it's because it's a very fast-moving venture we're doing. They're off in Australia. They're never up at the same time we're up. They're just out of the loop, and they're not able to participate. And when any of those are present, at least this one court said, well, you don't really have a true partnership. Those are the three things. Everybody's got it. So when you look at a DAO, you have to ask yourself, are all the participants, you know, sophisticated enough to, on their own basis, make those decisions? In many cases they are, but not always. Are they given the ability in reality to vote? And sometimes you have to take into account the weighting. So if, like, we had a DAO for our podcast thing, it was like a podcast DAO, but we held between the two of us 80% of the tokens, you know, the other people might have tokens and in theory could vote, but we could outvote them on everything, right? So that's not, so you have to look at each, DAOs are very, very tricky because, and then the last thing I would say, Alexa, is what is the purpose of the DAO? Is the DAO got a commercial purpose, or is it really more sort of a steward? And by steward, what I mean is particularly vis-a-vis protocols, people are there not really to make money, but just to ensure that nothing goes wrong, and they're willing to give their time into something, you know, sort of the people who, you know, for example, work in Linux in the, you know, regular world there. You know, they do that because they love the idea, the protocol, the system. They're not looking to make money by doing that. They do that in their spare time or something. And many DAOs work that way. People, there's a cause somebody cares about, and they're coming together and they're doing it. It's not primarily a business venture. So you have to take that into account as well. There are a lot of things. So it's a DAOs introduce a lot of difficult questions as to what are people's primary purpose, what are their sophistication? And then also you might say, well, there's maybe, you know, 150 people in this DAO. There's a couple of them. I don't really know how they got there, what they're doing. Does that sort of destroy the whole thing? You know, that's not crystal clear. You know, in theory, an argument can be made. One person is too many, you know, in theory. But again, that's an area where we don't have a lot of law because we've never really been able to manage large groups. I would be remiss in not mentioning that there are very important tax ramifications and non-securities law ramifications in DAOs, and that's something that people have to understand. I'm sure you've had other podcasts or talked about that, but if you do have a partnership, there are rules in the United States and I think in other jurisdictions as well that if you have more than 100 members of that partnership and it's deemed publicly traded, and what that means itself is not at all clear. But if, you know, it was deemed publicly traded, that would have other it would be taxed as a corporation. It's a set of rules that are designed to kind of protect against, you know, workarounds. Again, whether tokens traded on a DEX is publicly traded, that is a very unclear thing. But, you know, so there are a bunch of, and of course, as I'm sure, your listeners are aware, the potential of unlimited liability for any given DAO voting member, as we saw in the Oki DAO, or even just generalized member, non-voting potentially. So there's a lot of, you know, interesting and important legal questions, you know, to consider around this.
Yeah, definitely protecting your project legally in the best way possible is crucial for the project longer term. And I truly hope that the industry and the community is getting away from that. Well, I'm in crypto, I don't have to pay taxes, and there are no legal regulations that apply to me because I'm in crypto. Well, there are, and better be safe as soon as possible and not introduce yourselves to a bunch of potential risks and liabilities. Please clarify for us, why are securities so scary? Why is the whole environment, many projects, no, we don't want to be securities, we want to get away from that, what can we do not to be deemed securities? I mean, I would assume that one of the reasons is the need for KYCing, and the other one, as you mentioned, is quite lengthy and expensive process to get from the SEC. And is there anything else? Why are securities so scary for everyone?
Sure, it's a great question. I would not put KYC on that list because actually in certainly in the United States and in many other jurisdictions, individuals' obligations not to do business with sanctioned persons apply whether or not you're using securities or not. So if there are securities, there are added KYC obligations, but there are still important KYC considerations, even if they're not securities. And Tornado Cash, of course, reminded us all of that. So it's an important factor, but I wouldn't say it's a dominant factor. To me, Alexa, I would say the dominant factor is liquidity, really. Let's say the two of us, we have a whole long story. We're doing business. I'm selling you whiskey. We're starting a podcast thing. And we're having a great time, right? Let's say the two of us are at a bar and we're having drinks together, enjoying, we're having a nice time. And I say, you know, Alexa, I've got some securities in a private company I invested in last year. And to be honest, I've got some expenses. I think this is a great company. You know, I'd love for you to kind of buy those off of me. If you know, you could see your way clear to that. I think it's a win for me. I need the liquidity. It's a win for you. It's a great company. neither of us are broker dealers. We are no special. We're just two folks, right? And I have that conversation with you in a bar. That's fine. As long as I don't mislead you, as long as I don't make any statements that I know are either incorrect or knowingly misleading, I can sell you those securities, assuming they're not restricted at this time and what have you. That's not a problem. And the SEC has pointed this out with tokens. In theory, if tokens were securities, one person could always, generally speaking, sell those tokens to another person without restriction. Here's the catch. Unfortunately, the world would be a much better place if everybody sat next to everybody in a bar. But we don't all sit next to folks in a bar. We're here, we're there, we're all around the world. We need a marketplace. We need a venue for buyers and sellers to meet and create that liquidity. Without that, there's no token market. You need to have a functional way for price discovery and for buyers and sellers to find each other. With securities, that liquidity, that market making process is very regulated. That's very constrained. So only a national securities exchange can do that, of which we really only have two in the United States, the New York Stock Exchange and the NASDAQ. Similarly, you've got a finite number of securities exchanges in Europe, the London Stock Exchange and Deutsche Börse and, the various, national securities exchanges. Also, if I'm an investor and I want to leverage securities, there's a lot of different rules around how that occurs. If I want to custody the securities with somebody else, there are very formal rules for all of that. And none of those really fit into the digital asset space. Probably most importantly, not only is there liquidity implications, are there infrastructure implications, but you would need, in order for those securities to sort of fit into our larger framework, you would need to identify an issuer, because the issuer of a security has all kinds of obligations. For example, providing ongoing disclosures. But with a token, there's nobody, if somebody stands up and says, I'll take responsibility for this token, well, then it's not decentralized. Then you're killing the whole point of it. The whole point is that there isn't someone to stand up and make disclosures. So it just fundamentally doesn't work. It doesn't work from the point of view of liquidity, because you've got to have a way for buyers and sellers to find each other. And it doesn't work for this idea of an issuer. You'd have to impose an issuer, and when you do that, you're no longer decentralized. So you have this entity. So it really, the whole infrastructure of securities. Could you change our securities laws to make a special type of security? I call that an issuer independent security. Could you sort of rework? Yes, in theory, but when you're done reworking all of our securities laws, frankly, it'll be 10 years from now, and the whiskey will be ready to drink. But other than that, there'll not be much else good to say about the subject, right? So that's why I think we need to be very concerned about mislabeling digital assets as securities, because they're just these two frameworks don't fit. One of the bills that was introduced into Congress by Senators Cynthia Lummis of Wyoming and Kirsten Gillibrand of New York would actually add to our securities laws by creating new disclosure obligations for people who raise money by selling tokens, which we said earlier, of course, is securities activity. And it would impose on them disclosure obligations without treating the tokens as securities. I think an approach like that would be very effective, because it wouldn't require a complete rejiggering of all of our other laws. You could kind of the other way around, as it were, by rejiggering all our laws and sort of get to the same place. But why would you want to do that? It's kind of a dumb idea. So anyway, I've got to wrap up soon. So maybe one more question.
No, that would be all. And thank you again for coming on today and providing such great explanations to this topic. And I definitely hope that some of the new ideas will pass and we'll have some sort of an addition to the securities law that are more friendly towards digital assets and the industry.
Well, Alexa, thank you. You had great questions. I really enjoyed this and look forward to feedback. People can reach out to me on Twitter. I'm at NY Crypto Lawyer. So feel free to connect there or otherwise. And I look forward to following up.
Thank you for watching another episode of DAO Today with Alexa Mill. DAO Today podcast is for educational and thought-provoking purposes only. and nothing said by Alexa or her guests can be construed as legal, business, and/or financial advice. Projects mentioned in the episodes are referred to as examples for educational and informational purposes only. It does not constitute any sort of endorsement or promotion. See you in the next episode.